We've been going through the book of John, and we're almost through the first two chapters here after 5 weeks. And so today we are going to continue that study by looking at what happens in the latter part of John chapter 2. But before we get there, I have a loaded question for you, and that is, what makes you angry? Now, I am not typically an angry person. But I've told you this before, that when I'm going to preach on a certain subject, it often happens that that week there is something that makes me feel convicted about my own lack of what it is I'm going to be talking about. So this week I'm preaching on anger, and I pull up and there's a U-Haul truck parked across four parking spots right next to our building. I have some feelings about that. But what is it that makes you angry? What gets under your skin? Now, anger is a very human emotion. We all experience it in some way or another, and anger as a whole is kind of unavoidable. It's going to happen to us, and it's going to happen to us frequently. Now, some of us anger fairly easily. We have a short fuse, and it doesn't take a lot to light that fuse and get it to the anger bomb that is waiting on the other end. While there are others of us where it takes a great deal of negative stimulus to make us angry. Some are born with anger problems. Others seem able to let their anger be washed away in a sea of patience, which just makes the angry people more angry that they're able to do that. But to be fair, those people who seem so patient are probably screaming on the inside and rushing home to get out their voodoo dolls to torture whoever it is got under their skin. And you know the old saying, right? I don't get mad. I get even. And to this, I would argue you only want to get even because you got mad, which would totally help that person get to a healthier place and understand their emotions and feelings better. But we all know that there are different levels to the answers of this question, what makes you angry? So I'm going to take you through my levels of angry. Now, your levels may be different. You might have different triggers for those things. So don't get mad about it if yours are different than mine, okay? I might have more steps, you might have fewer, you might have more. But let's take a look here at what my steps are. My first step is annoyed/irritated. This can happen in any, multiple ways, like traffic. Let's just say traffic in general. It's taking you longer to get somewhere where you want to go. I'm not mad, but I'm definitely annoyed or irritated. Number two, frustrated. Now, what's the difference, you ask? Well, take that traffic up a notch to me helping my junior high child with his math homework, which I haven't taken math in a long time. I know you're shocked at that because you would think that a pastor needs to use math in his biblical studies all the time. But all you really need to know is 3 and 7. So you're good, right, in terms of that. Number three, and this is probably where I spend most of my angry time, would be brooding. I can be a brooder. Something doesn't go the way I wanted to, and I'm a little bit more than frustrated about it, but I also know I can't really do anything about it, so I just quietly smolder on the inside. Number four, salty. You know what salty is, right? So now I'm gonna express my frustration in some way, shape, or form, and it's not always a super negative or blowing up sort of experience, but maybe I'll just be a little bit more caustic than I might be in my normal conversations. Number five, mad. When I'm mad, I'm thinking unkind thoughts about those that have offended me, and perhaps even expressing those thoughts out loud to whatever space I am in. Number six, angry. I know what you're thinking, Bryce, these are all the same words. I'm telling you, they're not, because angry is different than mad, because when I'm angry, I feel the need to lash out and to perhaps injure someone based on whatever it is I want to say. When my final level here is furious, which means I do lash out, and maybe I also want to hit something. Not someone, but something. So those are basically my levels of angry. Now, raise your hand if you think this is relatively close to you. Raise your hand if you think that's true. Okay, raise your hand if your list is shorter than this. Fair? Okay, anyone's list longer than this? Okay, good, because I was going to call you out if your list was longer than this. This is a pretty long list of like the stages of anger. But I was looking for some more frames of references, about how to break this down, and Psychology Today was really helpful by helping me break down levels of anger through cartoon characters. So, number one, their number one level of anger is Yosemite Sam. Yosemite Sam is frustrated about a lot of things, but it's basically sort of this impotent anger, right? You know he's not going to hurt anyone, he's going to get over it, even though he is firing guns into the air. I know it's a bit of a paradox, but stick with me here. Number two, Donald Duck. Donald Duck is the next level of anger. And I didn't realize it until I was reading this article about how angry Donald Duck often is. And I wonder if it's because he's wearing a shirt and no pants. That could be part of it, I don't really know. Number three, the Tasmanian Devil, which I have a hard time seeing him as a level of anger because he just seems more like a whirlwind of things no matter how he feels, right? It's his mode of transportation. Is he really angry or is he just trying to get from point A to point B? I don't know. But finally, number four, and before you bring this up, Nisha, who can guess what the top level of cartoon anger is? It's pretty obvious, but I'm curious if you can get it. Wile E. Coyote? Nope. Elmer Fudd? Nope. Go ahead, Nisha. I know, right? It was right there in front of you. The Incredible Hulk, which, you know, Hulk smash. So that's pretty furious right there. So when you think about your own anger responses, when you think about, you know, the things that get under your skin and the things that make you feel certain things, where do you fall within these spectrums? How quickly do you go from one level of anger to another? And is there something in particular that just really heightens your ascent up the list? This week we are going to reflect on a time when Jesus got mad. And that's really sort of an understatement, I mean, even with mad being so far down my list, because he was really more angry than mad, and you might even say that he was furious. Definitely a little bit of the Hulk involved in this Jesus story, which it's weird, isn't it, to put Jesus into those terms. We don't really think about him in that way, do we? I mean, we've even sung songs like in our history about Jesus meek and lowly, and he's the lamb, and he's all these different things. Well, Jesus also has an edge to him, and he got angry when he went to the temple with his followers and saw what was going on within the temple courts. Now, before we get into the story, a couple things I want to point out to you about John's account. Number one, he tells this story at a very different time in the Jesus narrative than any of the other Gospels do. It kind of sounds familiar for John, right? That something fundamental is going to be different about it. Now, in the other three Gospels, this cleansing of the temple takes place on the Monday of the last week of Jesus' life. So he comes into the city of Jerusalem and in front of the big parade, the triumphal entry, and on Monday he goes and cleanses the temple. And within each of those narratives, it is perhaps that moment that solidifies his fate by the end of the week. The fact that he went into the temple, that he challenged the high priest, that he challenged the way that things were done in such a demonstrative way. But in John's gospel, it happens in chapter 2. Right from the beginning. Now, here's something else that we need to note. As we were last week in the beginning of chapter 2, Jesus was all the way in Cana. So, Nisha, if you bring up the map. So, Cana is up here. Click it one more time. There we go. There's Cana. So he was up here in Cana for the wedding. And then after that, he went home with his family, which most likely was to Capernaum, which is all the way up there. Now, where is the temple? It's in Jerusalem, which is approximately 90 miles in a straight line. That's a long way to walk, isn't it? And how long would that take? Several days if you just walked straight there and didn't do anything along the way. So, what does that tell us about John wanting this story to be here at the very beginning? He did it on purpose, even though he knows that some of the details around it are going to be a little, you know, different than you see, because, you know, in the other Gospels, Jesus basically stays up there for most of the time. Like, that's where he spends most of his time. But here he takes this extra trip down to Jerusalem, and he goes there for a Passover feast, according to John. Now, let's set the scene. If you've never seen a map of the temple in Jerusalem, I should have put a map up there today, and I didn't even think about it until right now. But if you have ever seen a map of the temple in Jerusalem, it has several courts. So there's a court for the Gentiles and women, there's a court for Jewish males, there's a court for the high priest. It goes like, and with each court gets smaller and fewer people can enter until you get to the Holy of Holies, where there is only one person who can enter the Holy of Holies, because that is the place where God lives. So what had happened was the court of the temple, the most outer court, was set up like a marketplace. And of course, that sounds bad to us that the outside court would be like a marketplace. But there was actually a really practical reason why it was set up this way. People would travel from all over the area to the temple for different festivals. And often, when you travel to the temple for a festival, you had to bring what? A sacrifice. That was one of the reasons to go to the temple. So consequently, there were stalls set up where people could buy the kind of animal they needed to sacrifice. And this might be where we need to slightly adjust our view on what biblical times were like, because maybe you assume that everybody had all these animals. But Jerusalem was a big city. So even if you were local to Jerusalem, you might still have to buy your animal from the temple courtyard, because not everyone had a farm, okay? They had stores they could go buy, or not stores, they had marketplaces where they could go buy the things that they needed. So this actually did have a very practical purpose. So someone could go and buy their sheep or their goats or their doves, whatever they were capable of doing at that time to sacrifice to God. And because people were traveling from much further places in the area to go here to Jerusalem, they also had tables that would basically transfer different kinds of currency. They would change money from one kind of money to the kind of money that they needed there at the temple or in Jerusalem. So they set up these booths there at the temple so that when you came into town and you went to the temple, you could buy your sacrifices, you could change the money, so you have the type of money that you need, and then you can spend your time there doing all of the other temple things. So that's not so bad, right? I mean, you could even probably argue that this was done to help people accomplish what they needed to accomplish at the temple. But it is clear, because most of us know this story, the story we're going to read here in just a moment, it's clear that in the mind of Jesus, the temple had become something it was not supposed to be. Regardless of why this stuff was set up or what purpose it served, it was taking away from the true purpose of the temple. So this story, and particularly in John, he adds a couple of ideas here that are not in the other Gospels. In this story, it is dramatic, and the actions of Jesus are definitive in their judgment. And we see a side of him that we do not see very often, if at all. So if you have your Bibles, open up to John chapter 2. We're going to start in verse 13. And what we have first within this scenario is action and reaction. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, the reason why they say up, even though he was coming from the north to the south, is that Jerusalem was on a hill. Not on a big hill, like we know hills and mountains, but it was still on a hill. So when people talked about going to Jerusalem, they always said they were going up to Jerusalem because they were literally going uphill. Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Now, Jesus went from zero to Hulk pretty quickly, didn't he? Although there's a stop in the middle, which we're going to talk about here in a second. And his response to the marketplace at the temple was basically disgust that graduated to rage. He entered the temple courts and saw what was going on, and what he saw deeply affected him. And I can almost picture him standing there in the entryway, looking around, taking it all in, and his eyes getting harder by the second. His face just turning into this mask of stone. And what is it that has made him so mad? Well, the temple is his father's house. It is the house of God. And because it's the house of God, it is a holy place for a holy God. We use that term holy a lot. We've talked about what it means. But it's important for us to revisit it here for just a moment. The term holy means set apart. It means that there is nothing like this thing, whatever that holy thing may be. And it has one singular purpose. So God himself is holy. There is no God like him. There is no God to compare to him. And the temple was the place where you could find God on earth at any given time. You've heard of the Ark of the Covenant from Indiana Jones, I assume, yes? So the Ark of the Covenant was considered to be the footstool of God, that though he might be anywhere else in the world at any time, his feet rested in that place. This is, for all intents and purposes, on earth, the house of the one living God. Kind of a big deal, right? And if something is truly holy, if it is truly set apart, if it is truly this special, there are certain things you don't do with it. Because if you do some of these certain things that you might do for, say, any other building or marketplace, you make the place itself fundamentally less special, less set apart. It's not what it is supposed to be. And when Jesus walks through that gate and he sees what's going on within that space, he recognizes that while this is still the house of the Lord, it is no longer a special place. It is no longer a holy place. It is no longer a place that is set apart for the purpose of worshiping God. But here's the extra salt on that wound. No one else seemed to have a problem with this. It was a normal day at the temple. In the other Gospels, it's just a Monday. It's just a normal day at the temple, and things were as they always were. And that, I think, to Jesus, was really the heart of this problem. It's not just that these things are happening. It's that nobody seems to care about how the presence of these things takes away from the awesomeness of God. I mean, if you can do the same things on the way to the temple, into the temple, that you can do in the marketplace, aren't those supposed to be two really fundamentally different things? Yes, they are, but no one seems to see this. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, what does this marketplace in the temple of God say, not about the people who set it up, but what does it say about God if this is what his house is like? Who is this God who requires you to go about the business of worshiping him? Why does he matter as a holy and set apart God if all that counts is making sure you have the correct sacrifice and you don't even have to plan ahead to do it? Where is the awe? Where's the wonder of knowing that you are entering the dwelling place of the holy God? It's not there. Which then asks the logical, taking this down the logical path, it asks this question. Well, is this space even holy anymore? And is the God that it was built to serve holy himself? How can we better understand this? I don't know. I was kind of searching for a way to kind of help us tie this together. But let's say that you're going to the Grand Canyon, and you've never been to the Grand Canyon before, and you understand that the Grand Canyon is going to be like super grand. It's in the title. You're stoked about the grandness of the Grand Canyon. And you pull up to the parking lot of the Grand Canyon thinking to yourself, it's kind of weird that the Grand Canyon has a parking lot. And you have to walk through a strip mall past places that are selling sandwiches and hot dogs, past a gift shop, past a laundromat, past a bank, past all these normal everyday things to get to the Grand Canyon. And as you're walking past these things you could have found at home, at the Grand Canyon, what are you asking yourself? Well, this is kind of weird. Do people really need to do laundry at the Grand Canyon? And you're going to get to the Grand Canyon, and guess what? The Grand Canyon is still grand. But for me, the experience is ruined. Because I'm not walking into the presence of something that is immediately taking my breath away. I'm reminded every step of the way of how even the biggest and most grand things are overrun by the mundane. I have to imagine that this is what Jesus is experiencing when he looks out there and sees this. So Jesus is not happy. And John adds this detail, which is my favorite detail of this story, where Jesus sees what's going on and he walks over to the side. And he takes these cords, we don't know what they're made of or anything like that, but he takes these cords and he starts weaving them together to make a whip. Now, I don't know what you think about this, but I imagine that Jesus is standing there as he's putting these cords together, looking around and choosing his targets. He's fuming. It's not even the calm, it's the quiet before the storm. And what does it tell us that Jesus saw fit to step aside and make a weapon in order to handle this problem? Does it seem extreme? It kind of does. Yeah. And John, like I said, John is the only one who puts this thing, this particular moment in there. And once the whip was made, Jesus went on an outright rampage in the temple courts. Imagine this. You're standing there, you're, you know, waiting for your animal. Maybe you're like in line to get to the actual place where you'll give your sacrifice over, and you hear people start yelling. And then those yells turn to screams. And then animals are running everywhere. And people are shouting. Someone runs into you from behind. You're wondering what's going on, and you turn around, and there's a single man swinging a whip over his head and bringing it down on whatever it is he wants to bring it down upon. It was a one-man riot. And when he has driven the animals out, he goes back and overturns the table. So now there's money flying everywhere, which just causes more chaos, doesn't it? Because when money's flying, what do people want to do? They want to pick up the money. And Jesus' only concern is to drive them out, and he takes a special moment of patience with those who are selling doves. He doesn't just set them free. He's like, get those doves out of here. And so they take them all out. There's no way around this part of the story that will help us make Jesus look more in control, less rageful, less angry, because these actions are the actions of a man who is furious. Righteously so, but furious. And who starts destroying things in his righteous anger. That's kind of uncomfortable for us to deal with, but John tells us the story he needs us to hear. But it makes me think of another question I want us to address just briefly. How do we, here today, how do we deal with the anger of God? What do we do with that concept? Because here's the thing, the God of the Bible is a complex God. We like to make him simple. But he's not. He has intense feelings about a lot of things. In particular, he has intense feelings about us, about who we are, about what we do, about the lives that we live. He loves his creation, but he is also hurt by his creation. And sometimes we don't like to recognize this, but the feelings go both ways. He can't love us with a love we can't compare and understand in any other way, and also be indifferent to the things we do to him. Those two things can't coexist, can they? Such intense feeling can't give way to indifference. So God's anger is a concept that we struggle with, and here are some things that I think we think about the anger of God. And number one, we don't think God should get angry. Really, we don't. And I think we can rationalize this a lot of different ways, but I think probably one of the things we want to think is that God is above anger. Anger is too petty for God. He shouldn't be angry. And I love how we, who have very little control over our own feelings, presume to judge what God should and shouldn't do with his own feelings. Well, he's God. He shouldn't be angry. And that leads us to a second thing, is we don't want God to be responsive to the things we do that make him angry. He shouldn't feel it in the first place. And we think, therefore, it isn't right for God to respond to us out of anger. Again, he should be above this, being angry at us and responding to us. Which, if we actually read the Bible, not only are there multiple accounts of God getting angry, but we also have a verse like this one from Hebrews chapter 10, verses 30 through 31. For we know him who said, it is mine to avenge, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people because, and I love this one, it is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. I recommend if you're talking to any of your non-Christian friends about following Jesus, you lead with verse 31. It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And this is where maybe our thinking gets the most simplistic and the most unfair. We believe that ultimately his patience and love for us should override his anger, his frustration, his irritation. And to just drive that nail home, we say, well, if he's a loving God, then can you believe that? I mean, I know you can, because we've all thought it or said it or been in conversations where this idea has been expressed. That somehow, God being so invested in us that he gets angry, that he gets upset, and that there are repercussions for turning our backs on the living God, that somehow the fact that those things can happen means he doesn't actually love us. Shame on us. Shame on us for wanting all of the power of a loving God without any of the teeth. A holy, righteous, set apart, all-powerful God is all of those things. And when we think these in some of these moments, we are forgetting just how patient and loving and graceful God is to us. This story tells us something we need to hear, and that is this. God matters. Who he is matters. How we represent him matters. And in particular, in this case, if we misrepresent him, we are turning God into something he is not. And that's not his problem, that's ours. And if we keep doing this, though, God is going to make it his problem. And when he walks into our temple courts and he sees that it's become a marketplace, takes us to the next part of the story, verses 18 through 22. Leads to a weird interaction coming out of this. So we have to think, you know, as we read this, that there has been at least some amount of time that's passed between what happened in the temple and this conversation, because otherwise it doesn't make a lot of sense. The Jews then responded to him, "What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days." They replied, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple and you are going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. So now we're seeing that this account that John gives us is really kind of two stories rolled into one. There's a story of what happens at the temple, and then the story of these conversations that happen after. And fortunately, Jesus has calmed down at this point, to where he can have a conversation with those who were there, and in particular, the authorities that were there, those who want to know what makes you think you can do this. Prove to me that you can do this. Who gave you the right to mess up the temple? Who gave you the right to say this is the wrong thing to do? Who said you can decide that we can't have this here? Show me a sign. Now, what might they have been looking for when they say show me a sign? Like, what do they want? Do they want to turn a dove into a goat? You know, do they want him to... I don't know. Like, it's hard for me to understand what it is that they're asking for within this context. And the answer that Jesus gave them didn't scratch any of the itches they had. Okay? Because look at what he said. He didn't give them a sign, but instead, he predicts his death. And this prediction of his death is the only prediction of his death in the Gospel of John. This is the only place this happens. Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. And the response of the people around him had to be, what? I asked you for a sign, and you're giving some sort of weird riddle. There's two things to note, though. Number one, this is not any sort of sign that they can do anything with. If they were looking for a display of power to show that God was with Jesus, they didn't get it. And number two, they have absolutely no idea what Jesus is talking about. None. This comment is completely over their heads, and Jesus did that on purpose. They ask for a sign. He gives them an answer they can't do anything with. And their response is, what are you talking about? So the only thing they can do is take his response literally. It took 46 years to build this place. What do you mean if it's torn down, it will be rebuilt in 3 days? That makes no sense. And the question we have to ask is, could they have understood this statement any differently than the way that they did? No. This is, in fact, the only way they could have understood this statement. Which is why verse 22 then becomes so important to us. John says in verse 22 that nothing concerning Jesus could be fully comprehended until he was risen, until he was resurrected. And we tend to pass judgment on the people of the gospel at times for their lack of faith. I mean, if I met Jesus, if I had seen this, if I had heard that, why didn't they know also? Why didn't they understand? Why didn't they get it? And the answer is simple. John tells us they didn't have all the information. They didn't have all the information because they had not yet met the risen Jesus. And until they meet the risen Jesus, there's a part of all of this that's going to make no sense. Just none. And so, as I got a question this week from Aaron, why is it that the disciples declare that Jesus is the Messiah in chapter 1 and then seem to waffle through the rest of the gospel? They didn't know. They couldn't know. They wouldn't know until they experience the risen Lord. For John, then, an encounter with the risen Jesus is kind of the only way, the only reason, why anyone would be all in on this thing. It's not until you know him in this way that you understand who he is. Because, here's the lesson, you cannot fully comprehend what God is doing if you don't know the resurrected Jesus. Finally, let's get down to the heart of the problem. Why did Jesus react the way that he did in the temple courts? Why did he do all these things? And maybe there's this expectation we might have in retrospect, like, why didn't he just talk to everyone about it? Hey, gang, get it in here. Here's what's going on. Well, these last verses are pretty convicting. Starting in verse 23. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. Ouch! Right? John, pull some punches, dude. We're only in chapter 2. I don't need this in chapter 2. This verse challenges us, however, to see the world how Jesus had to have seen the world. And you know, we talk an awful lot about Jesus being the embodiment of God's love in this place, which he is, in fact, the embodiment of God's love. And if there is anything we learn from Jesus, it's about how much God loves us, isn't it? That is always the lesson. That is always the takeaway with Jesus. But imagine for a moment that you are the Son of God, here since the creation of the world, everything around you you have helped create. And people walk up to you and say, "Who are you? Give me a sign." He taught, he performed signs. Some people heard, some people saw, some believed, others did not. And how challenging must it have been for Jesus to have to prove himself to his creation, that his word to them was not enough. And this is how his ministry started. This is why we have this moment where we do in the Gospel of John, because this tells us everything we need to know about how things are going to go for Jesus when he's here in this world. People arguing over who he was, demanding that he prove himself through signs. This is how things would continue to be. Even after his death and resurrection, even with people who meet the risen Lord, it's still going to be this way. This is how things are. And you know, sometimes we fall into the trap of saying to ourselves or in conversations with other people, again, like, if Jesus wants everyone to believe in him, then why doesn't he make it more obvious for us today? Why doesn't he do that? You heard that before, I'm assuming. You mean more obvious than God becoming a man, doing miraculous things, dying and raising from the dead? More than that? Is that what you mean? Underneath all this is an uncomfortable truth that Jesus knows what people are like. And if we take John's word for it, what did he know people are like? Not to be trusted. People are not to be trusted. And how does he know people are not to be trusted? He knows our hearts, our minds, our intent. So when Jesus walked into the temple that day and he saw what was happening in the marketplace, he knew that talking us through it would accomplish nothing. He knew the excuses we would give. He knew the rationales we would say for why things are the way they are. He knew how they would argue, this doesn't take away from who God is. It makes it easier to worship him. And Jesus made a choice. And in the face of a people who could not be trusted with their God, he stood up in the house of the Lord. And in doing so, he stood up for God himself. And he did not choose to gently remove those people who would turn God's house into a place of transactions. Instead, he drove them out. And overlying this whole thing is that question again. Who gave you the authority to do this? Well, whose house is this? That's the one who gave me the authority. Look, God has great passion for his people, therefore it matters tremendously what kind of image his people communicate about him. What are his people telling the world about who he is? Because if God's great desire is that we know him, and that we understand him, and that we know how much he loves us, then we, who are representatives of God here on earth, what we say, what we do, what we communicate about him matters more than we may like to admit. And the way his people represent him may push those who don't know him away from him forever. And we see in this marketplace that the people of God had removed the things that draw people to God in the first place. That he is an all-powerful creator who is in relationship with his people, making a way for them to be in relationship with him. And this three easy steps to get to God robbed God of who he actually is. I mean, shoot, people might get priced out of the kingdom. They might never understand that God is a God of love instead of a God of the bottom line. Jesus had a right, didn't he? But that's not what's remarkable about this story. John lays bare for us how these people are. He lays bare for us the worst example of how people have made God into something he's not. And in the middle of this terrible sandwich, what does he say is the key to all of this? It is his death and his resurrection. You get it? Do you see what he did? Look, these people are terrible. They totally don't understand God. They've made his place a marketplace. This is awful. They need to be driven out, and I'm here to die for them. That by living again, they can come to know this God that they don't appreciate in a way that they don't understand and can never even imagine right now. Because man, when they meet the risen Savior, that is going to change things. That is going to make this story different. That is going to create what God has wanted all along. For as much as he was a son of God who drove people out of that temple with a whip, he also was the Lamb of God, who said the answer is that this temple will be torn down and rebuilt in 3 days. For what God was doing was bigger than the people there that day. It was bigger than the temple itself. It was bigger than anyone could have understood. And this is what the story really is about. It's not about Jesus being angry. It's not about how right he was in being angry. It's not what people did or did not understand. It is about a God who is passionate about his people. So passionate, so overwhelmed by his love for his people that he sends his son to the earth to be treated however we're going to treat him. But he still came anyway. And the cross was in front of him, and he still came anyway. He still died, and his resurrection has changed the world.